Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, March 23rd, 2022. Alamito Foundation outfitted with new weather soil monitoring stations by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County, 20 miles south of Marfa on the Alamito Foundation Ranch, a new self-contained solar-powered weather and soil monitoring station is providing real-time data on the area's temperature, wind speed, solar radiation and rainfall, as well as soil temperature and moisture levels. The weather and soil monitoring stations were installed by the Texas Water Development Board, TWDB, in late February with the help of locals Ernesto Subia, Eduardo Ocon, and Nevin Nunez, along with Alamito Foundation employees, Programs Director Caroline Travis, and Land Operations Manager Dr. Lynn Loomis. It helps the TWDB connect the data across the state and helps us because we have live weather updates for the ranch, said Travis. The newly established Alamito Foundation, which is awaiting official nonprofit status, is the brainchild of Marfa resident Gary Wilbanks, co-founder and principal of Teal System and Republican candidate for Presidio County Commissioner, Precinct 4. The foundation's mission is twofold: to improve the lives of Big Bend's youth through educational programs and career preparation, and to practice responsible land management by restoring native grasses and protecting watersheds on its 3,400-acre ranch located in the Alamito Valley. The foundation considered purchasing the whole weather and soil monitoring system themselves, said Travis, which costs around $20,000, but discovered the TWDB would install the equipment for free on behalf of their Tex Mesonet program, which was established in 2016. Data collected at the site can help forecast weather and determine when fire and freeze warnings need to be issued, according to the TWDB. For the Alamito Foundation, specific weather data about their property will also be utilized to make decisions about when to perform certain ranch operations, like prescribed burns, which revolve around rainfall and wind data, said Travis. Travis said by installing the station early on, the foundation will be able to gather data over a longer period of time, helping them notice weather trends and patterns on the property. This gives us information from our homes. It's going to be really cool to see over the next 20 to 30 years just the patterns of weather out here and how that affects the land coverage and the land restoration process, said Travis. The Alamito Foundation's site joins a network of around 88 TWDB data gathering sites around the state, including sites in Jeff Davis, Reeves, Culberson, and Pecos counties. By dispersing weather and soil monitoring stations across the vast region of Far West Texas, data can be collected to represent various ecological zones that may differ greatly in conditions. In Presidio County, another station installed last year collects data in what is considered the hot desert shrub vegetative zone, while weather data collected at the Alamito Foundation Ranch helps represent the desert grassland vegetative zone. The Texas Soil Observation Network also operates six stations on the Mims Ranch, north of Marfa, which represent the mixed prairie vegetative zone. photo courtesy of the Alamito Foundation. From left, Lauren Boss, Mark Olden, Ernesto Subia, Eduardo Ocon, Nevin Nunez, and Dr. Lynn Loomis, who recently helped install a weather and soil monitoring station on the Alamito Foundation ranch property south of Marfa. City of Presidio passes hazardous materials ordinance by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Presidio. At Monday night's regular meeting, Presidio City Council passed its first ordinance aimed at restricting the commercial transport of hazardous materials through the city. The ordinance prohibits transloading of hazardous materials over 5,000 gallons within city limits and introduces a legal framework to eventually designate a hazardous materials route for cargo bound for the Presidio International Bridge. The ordinance was drafted by City Council members and their legal advisors in response to a planned diesel transport operation that investors hope will mark the rebirth of rail in Presidio. The operation would entail the shipment of diesel to Presidio by rail, where the fuel would be transferred onto tanker trucks through a process called transloading. 75 to 150 trucks a week would then make their way through the heart of Presidio on their journey to the bridge. Locals have raised numerous health and safety concerns in the months since the plan was revealed, and Presidio County officials have worked to update their emergency response plan to include hazmat-related incidents. The trucking route, as proposed by Strobel Energy Group, the company responsible for potentially transloading the fuel, would truck thousands of gallons of hazardous material past the Presidio Elementary School every week, which has been a subject of concern for some officials. Presidio officials hope to expand business and economic opportunities in the remote border city. The Presidio Port of Entry is classified as a small port by Customs and Border Protection, but with quick access to Chihuahua City, there's room to grow. Big trucks are coming, and they're wanting to go through Presidio, City Administrator Brad Newton told a handful of representatives from State Senator Cesar Blanco's office on Zoom in February. Still, locals hope that the inevitable growth can be balanced with care for the health and safety of Presidio residents. "It's a lot of hazmat, and we're not ready for it," council member and former Presidio first responder John Razzo said back in January. Beyond potential threats to human safety, there's the local ecosystem to consider. The transloading and trucking route is located uphill from a number of drainages into the Rio Grande, meaning that any major spill would inevitably end up in the river. Presidio Municipal Development Director Jaron Stevens hired registered environmental manager Andrew Price to survey the groundwater in Presidio, revealing that many of Presidio's wells are just 7 feet below the surface of the ground. The hydrology data determines severe risk presented by large volumes of hazardous materials being transloaded and transported in a populated area with shallow groundwater and close proximity to the Rio Grande River, Price's report reads. It is imperative that such risk not be pursued. This is the equivalent of creating a worst-case scenario or the perfect storm. The ordinance as written originally included language relegating the transport of hazardous materials to a hazardous materials route, but such a route has not yet been designated. The last time the ordinance was discussed at City Council, Presidio City Attorney Ron Ponton explained that while it was common for cities to designate hazardous materials routes, they could not ban hazardous materials from state highways. Councilmember Arian Velasquez Ornelas worried that if the language alluding to a hazardous materials route were left unchanged, the city could be vulnerable to legal challenges. What if somebody comes along and says, well, this ordinance is not legal because there is no route? Ponton agreed. I would recommend taking out the references to a hazardous material route, he said. It's illegal for us to do without going through the process of designating the route. Instead, you could say, commercial motor vehicles transporting hazardous materials shall not depart state highways. City Council members adopted the changes and passed the ordinance. While Mayor John Ferguson and City Administrator Brad Newton were absent from the meeting, Mayor Pro Tempore John Razzo still had a quorum with Arian Velasquez Ornelas, Joe Andy Mendoza, Nancy Aravalo, and Abel Billy Hernandez voting in favor. The new ordinance's biggest challenge to the proposed diesel transport operation is its outright ban on transloading of hazardous materials over 5,000 gallons within city limits. Transloading, while common along the U.S.-Mexico border, is illegal in Mexico due to corruption and safety concerns. The quantity specified by the ordinance wouldn't affect transloading of fuel to local gas stations, which are typically served by smaller trucks. Ponton also added language to the ordinance to specify that trucks with hazardous materials heading to a regularly scheduled delivery to a commercial business or on their way for mechanic services would be exempt from the law. Large tanker trucks, on the other hand, can transport more than 11,000 gallons of fuel at a time, meaning that the ordinance could severely impede investors' ability to make a profit on the project in Presidio. The penalty for exceeding the transloading limit is a misdemeanor. City officials hope to eventually work together with TxDOT to designate a hazardous materials bypass around the city of Presidio to help accommodate larger volumes of truck traffic headed for the bridge. Because the Presidio International Bridge is the only international bridge in Texas owned by the state, it will likely be a drawn-out trial-and-error process as the two entities work together to grow international trade. Thank you for your patience in this process, Councilmember Arian Velasquez Ornelas told the crowd assembled at Monday's meeting. The City of Marfa adopts new ordinance regarding regulation of food establishments, issues new permit requirement. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. Food establishments within Marfa city limits, including restaurants, retail food stores, temporary food establishments, mobile food units, and roadside food vendors are now required to obtain a permit from the city in order to operate, with a deadline of March 31st. A new ordinance recently approved by City Council adopts Texas food establishment rules and requires a city-led inspection, focusing on adequate grease traps be completed before permits are issued. Establishments which have passed state health inspections should already meet Texas food establishment rules, said City Manager Mandy Roan. The purpose of this ordinance is to protect both public health and the public wastewater system, states the city's website. Roan said the new process will also allow for the city to regulate all businesses fairly across the board, an issue previously raised as a concern, she said. Making sure that all food establishments are being held to the same standards listed in the permit application seems like a reasonable way to do that, said Roan. The ordinance further outlines various processes regarding food establishments, including a requirement to submit construction plans before work has begun if extensively remodeling or converting an existing structure. Nonprofit organizations, such as churches, are exempt from the city's new permit requirement, but must still comply with state rules, according to the city. Food establishments without a posted permit will face a $2,000 fine plus court costs. There is no fee to apply for the permit, which holders will need to renew annually. The one-page permit application, which can be found on the city's website, inquires as to whether at least one employee holds a Texas Food Manager's certification or a Food Protection Manager certification, whether the facility is outfitted with a grease trap, as required by another city ordinance, and the pound capacity and company name of the grease trap. Copies of a most recent health inspection and Texas sales tax ID permit must also be submitted along with the application. In a city council meeting hosted in early February, council members in Roan discussed establishing stricter guidelines for food establishments and people selling food out of their homes after it was discovered discarded grease was causing issues with the city's wastewater system. Public Works Supervisor Chuck Salgado and his team were visiting establishments to check for proper grease trap size and maintenance at the time. At the February City Council meeting, Roan said the ordinance was meant to ensure anyone selling food was making it in a commercial kitchen, so conditions could be properly regulated. According to Texas food establishment rules, which the city is adopting, regulations do not apply to foods allowed by Texas cottage food laws, primarily baked goods and other items. Roan said essentially anyone selling food that could spoil, depending on time and temperature requirements, will need a permit. The Code Enforcement Department will see the new ordinance as being followed. According to Roan, Salgado and representatives from the Code Enforcement Department are checking in with local establishments this week to make sure they are aware of the new permit requirements. So far, Roan was only aware of two establishments that have submitted permit applications, she said. The new guidelines and permit requirements could make it difficult for someone making and selling food out of their home to operate legally. During the pandemic, some local citizens began selling food out of their homes for the community after restaurants ceased operations. Local food truck Line Thai got their start delivering food to Marfa residents before scaling up their operation. Marfa resident Natanya Friedman recently began making and selling food out of her home on Monday nights when most local restaurants are closed and has consistently received around 20 to 25 customers each week, she said. Friedman is an Ayurvedic health counselor and has plans to open Marfa Health House, a brick-and-mortar yoga studio, in the near future. She said she enjoys participating in the holistic health practice of Ayurveda by providing nutritional food for others. This week, at home, she was cooking up a large batch of vegan rainbow tabbouleh, which consisted of Swiss chard, asparagus, roasted almonds, couscous, lemon juice, and more, and is meant to promote liver health. What's the easiest way to allow people to come into health? Through a meal prepared by somebody else with a lot of love that day. It's super fresh, said Friedman. My goal is to help people be healthy. She said she personally takes care to properly prepare ingredients and compost the waste from the meals she makes. Friedman said she finds cooking for others fulfilling, and it allows her to make a good chunk of money in the process. It's a great way for people to make an income in a way that both serves them and their community, said Friedman. Friedman said she is unsure how the city permitting process will affect her business, but said the level of control and need for regulation is frustrating. I'm not going to get fined for this. I'm not going to start a rampage, said Friedman, but I enjoyed it. My customers enjoyed it, and it's a shame. Marfa resident David Gomez, who used to run Marfa Mystery Wings out of his home, released an episode of his podcast, Just Talk, this week, dedicated to his point of view on the city's new food establishment ordinance. He said he understood the reasons for the ordinance, but in the end was mostly against it. On the podcast, Gomez said when he sold wings, it allowed him to make extra money, and he believes others should be able to continue to operate home food businesses as long as they have a food handler's permit, as he did while operating Marfa Mystery Wings. I just feel that this ordinance in some aspects is bad because it's not letting people make that extra buck, said Gomez in the Just Talk episode. I would start selling again if I could because it was such good money and it was something that this town didn't have or doesn't have. He said for individuals who cannot work, selling food out of their homes can help them stay afloat financially. Gomez said he has heard some people argue that homegrown culinary operations take businesses away from traditional restaurants that are struggling to turn a profit. But, he said, the local real estate market in Marfa makes the prospect of opening a formal restaurant inaccessible for many people, and it's nice to have more food options. A lot of people in this town support one another, so if somebody is posting that they're selling Mexican plates, like flautas or enchiladas or something, I know I'm going to support them because they're trying to make a living, said Gomez. Editor's note, Natanya Friedman works part-time in the coffee shop restaurant side of the Sentinel. Marfa resident Natanya Friedman puts the finishing touches on her vegan rainbow tabbouleh in her home kitchen. Friedman has been cooking and selling healthy food on Monday nights for fellow Marfa community members, but a new city ordinance might cause her to cease the practice. Photo by Mary Cantrell. Parks and Recreation Board, Citizens, Select Design for Caulfield Park, Gazebo Editions. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Windswept parkgoers filtered into the Marfa Activity Center Gymnasium last week to shelter from the dust and voice their opinions on the Caulfield Park Improvement Project's latest design plans. Those gathered settled on a design that will see separate bathroom and kitchen structures built behind the existing gazebo. The Marfa Parks and Recreation Board is presently looking to improve the park's amenities, while keeping in mind future larger-scale upgrades dependent upon the MAC MAC feasibility study, which is currently underway, and a forthcoming master plan for the park. We are putting the buildings behind the gazebo so that they enhance the gazebo that's there without changing the whole view and feel of the park, said Board President Trey Gerfers. Other board members present were Council Member Buck Johnston, Joe Cassiola, Marshall Ramsey, and Mayor Pro Tem Irma Salgado. Robert McFessel, President of DSGN Associates, who lives part-time in Marfa, led the presentation on two potential design schemes for gazebo additions. Both included new three-stalled restrooms for men and women, a full kitchen complete with stove, refrigerator, sink, and counter, plus a storage area. In keeping with the look of the existing stone gazebo, additional structures would be built from the same materials and include a similar pitch metal roof, said McFessel. The concrete plaza will also remain. Facilities will not be air-conditioned, but will include open-air ventilation. They're not going to be smelly, grungy restrooms. They are going to be very airy and open. Think like a good TxDOT restroom, which you might go to, said McFessel. When put up for a vote, meeting attendees unanimously voted for the scheme that involved building separate bathroom and kitchen structures on either side of the gazebo, which would allow for the area directly behind the gazebo to remain open. The less favored design situated the bathrooms and kitchen in the same building directly behind the gazebo. The two-structure scheme was slightly bigger and more expensive than the singular build scheme. Marfa resident Luis Pippin brought forth the idea to further optimize the chosen design by swapping the locations of kitchen and the bathroom in order to make bathrooms closer for people utilizing the park. Resident P.J. Serrano agreed, saying it would be better to have a clear vantage point from the fields and courts to the restrooms so parents could keep a close eye on their children. Serrano also wondered whether traditional concrete paths connecting the three structures could be expanded to envelop the whole area, offering more space for chairs and tables. McFessel suggested decomposed granite might be a more suitable option in order to prevent runoff. Ensuring the gazebo, plaza, bathrooms, and kitchen are handicap accessible is also one of the major challenges going forward, said McFessel. A discussion ensued as to what location would allow for optimal handicap parking spots. The idea of a handicap parking spot near the volleyball courts would allow for a straight shot to the gazebo over flat terrain, some said. Gerfers agreed and said the final design will also include an accessible temporary spot for cars to drop off supplies, whether it be band equipment or coolers, at the facility. The next steps in fully realizing the designs are to obtain construction drawings, permits, and hire a construction crew. McFessel said construction would likely take around 6 months to complete. This is a pretty simple job, said McFessel. Funding for the project has already been obtained, said Gerfers, but one of his major concerns is finding a construction company that could be made available sooner rather than later, he said. Anybody good is going to be booked, said Gerfers. With many board members expressing optimism that the straightforward construction could be done in a timely manner, though the exact construction timeline is up in the air, the meeting moved toward discussing the future of the park as a whole. Gerfers said a master plan has yet to be created and is somewhat hinging on the completion of the MAC feasibility study, which is set to be done in late April. The city and the Parks Board split the fee to have the feasibility study performed, Gerfers said. Gerfers insisted meeting attendees there would have many more opportunities for public comment regarding the park's forthcoming master plan design. One of the long-term goals of the Parks Board is to close West Texas Street, which runs through Caulfield Park, in order to decrease traffic, adding parking instead of around the park's perimeter. The city has already approved the eventual closure, said Gerfers. Gerfers said while it would be the most organic to be able to address the entire park as a whole, bathrooms are badly needed, as well as electrical upgrades, and funding is there to fix those issues now. We want to do this, so we're going to make the gazebo amenity now, and then we're going to fold that into whatever other design things we add. A skate park, a tennis court, there's lots of different ideas out there, said Gerfers. Situated in the center of the MAC building, fields and courts, the gazebo, and further future accompanying amenities are essentially the heart of the park, said McFessel. This is the high point of the park. The gazebo sort of sits up there like the Acropolis. It has pretty good views in all directions, said McFessel. Architectural rending courtesy DSG and Associates. A preliminary design for two additional structures will be built to accompany the existing Caulfield Park gazebo. At a meeting hosted last week by Marfa's Parks and Recreation Board, members of the public weighed in on two potential designs, voting unanimously for the option with separate kitchen and bathroom facilities.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 17th. Contract renewed with AirMedCare. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The contract with AirMedCare Network to provide air transport for medical necessity was renewed when the Ward County Commissioners met in regular session on Monday morning. Transport for any county resident must be from a pickup location in Ward County or picked up from Reeves County Hospital in Pecos for the benefit of the residents in the western part of the county. AirMedCare will bill the patient's health insurance and no further out-of-pocket will be required. If the patient is uninsured, that person will be billed at the Medicare allowable rate. Ward County will pay $68,600 for the annual contract, which is the same as last year. The agreement is valid for 1 year from the time AirMedCare receives the signed agreement and payment. Additionally, county residents may purchase a household upgrade to cover transport from anywhere served by the AirMedCare network. Cost for the additional coverage is $45 for the standard rate or $35 for seniors. Quote, "This is one of the best things we do for our citizens," Commissioner Larry Hanna said. In addition to Hanna, Commissioners Tino Sanchez, Dexter Nichols, and Eddie Nelms were present for the meeting. County Judge Greg Holly was also present. In a separate action, the commissioners approved the notice of the upcoming special election. The special election, which will be held on May 7th, is for two State of Texas constitutional amendments. Proposition 1 would authorize the state legislature to reduce the property tax limit for school maintenance and operations taxes imposed on the homesteads of elderly or disabled residents to reflect any tax rate reduction enacted by law from the preceding tax year. Proposition 2 would increase the homestead exemption for school district property taxes from $25,000 to $40,000. Early voting will be held in the County Clerk's Office, Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen Street, beginning on April 25th and ending on May 3rd. Hours will be from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. The May 7th election will be at the precinct voting locations from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. At the request of Ward County Appraisal District Director Norma Valdez, the commissioners approved allowing appraisal district employees to participate in the county health insurance plans. The appraisal district will cover the cost of premiums. Quote, "This will lower insurance costs for our four employees and help with retention," Valdez said. Two requests from companies to cross county roads for pipeline purposes was approved. The commissioners ratified the action of the Ward Memorial Hospital managers to accept a $3 million grant from the FMH Foundation to be used for renovation of hospital rooms. Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez, who was present for the meeting, said, quote, "Architect Bill Parsons has estimated a cost of $5.4 million and could begin in June-July timeframe. We also have a $1 million USDA grant to help with the cost," end quote. The commissioners also approved electing the standard allowance for use of ARPA, American Rescue Plan Act, funds for government services. Quote, right now, funds are available and we could get up to $1 million, but no guarantee the government won't stop the program, Holly said. Payment of bills totaling $2.1 million was approved. Two small budget amendments were also approved. The district attorney pretrial fund expenses was increased by $8,000, and the general fund for the museum complex was increased by $384. According to the latest Keach-Byram Drought Index, the index in Ward County is now an average of 620 on a scale of 0 to 800, with the higher the number, the worse the drought conditions. As such, the commissioners renew the outdoor burn ban for another 90 days in unincorporated areas of the county. The ban does not prohibit burning of household trash in containers covered with metal grating, outdoor cooking, or burning in metal pits and grills, or other activities as permitted by the Ward County Fire Marshal. Violations of the order are a Class C misdemeanor and could be punishable by a fine not to exceed $500. The order of 143rd District Judge Mike Swanson setting the salary for the court reporter was acknowledged. The salary is based on population of the three counties that comprise the 143rd Judicial District. Ward County has 43% of the population and will pay $3,400 monthly of the total of $7,800 per month. Reeves County will pay $4,400 and Loving County will pay $23. The county treasurer's monthly report was also approved, reflecting a balance of $89.1 million as of February 28th. Beginning monthly balance was $81.3 million. In routine business matters, county officers' reports and minutes of the February 28th meeting were approved. The next meeting of the commissioners will be held at 9:30 a.m. on March 28th at the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. The meeting is open to the public. Father given 14 months in state jail for kids testing positive for meth. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahan's father, who was indicted last February on two charges of child endangerment after his children, all under the age of 9, tested positive for methamphetamine, has been sentenced to state jail. Daniel Ray Marshall, age 32, of 1805 West 2nd Street, was charged with two counts of abandoned endangered child, criminal negligence, a state jail felony, after Child Protective Services reported Marshall and the children's mother, Michelle Miller, age 31, for drug use, as well as their children testing positive for illegal narcotics, according to the police report. Marshall waived his right to a jury trial and accepted a plea agreement. On March 14th, District Judge Mike Swanson sentenced him to 14 months in the state jail division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice on both charges. These sentences will run concurrently. Both offenses occurred on October 9, 2019. The arrest came after an ongoing Child and Protective Services investigation. According to court documents, quote, CPS representatives brought the positive drug test results for Miller and Marshall's and their three children, ages 9, 3, and 2, to the Monahans Police Department, and as a result of the investigation, arrest warrants for the children's parents were obtained, which charged them with abandonment, endangered child, imminent danger. As per CPS protocol, the children were removed from the home and placed in their custody. Subsequently, Miller was picked up on November 15, 2019, on two of the warrants for introducing methamphetamines to the system of a child, and after being on the lam, Marshall was arrested on November 26, 2019, in Monahans. Both grand jury indictments state Marshall did engage in conduct that put two of his children in imminent danger of death, bodily injury, or mental impairment by introducing methamphetamine into the child's body. Also, Marshall did not voluntarily get the children any medical attention. He was further ordered to pay $498 in court costs and was given credit for 442 days credit for time served toward his sentence. According to court documents, Miller has not been indicted on either charge. Denman sentenced in 2021 copper theft at power plant. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man has been sentenced to 4 years in prison for stealing copper bars from the Luminant Permian power plant last September. Kenny Dwayne Denman, age 35, of 2708 West 4th Street, was booked into the Ward County Jail on a warrant charging him with theft greater than or equal to $30,000 and less than $150,000, a third-degree felony last year, after authorities were able to identify him as a suspect in the theft case through the use of technology. Denman appeared in the 143rd District Court in front of Judge Mike Swanson on March 8th, and as part of a plea agreement, he waived his right to a jury trial and pled guilty to the felony offense. Swanson ordered Denman to serve 4 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Public Safety. He was further ordered to pay $393 in court costs and was given 156 days credit toward his sentence for time served. District Attorney Randall Reynolds served as attorney for the case. Nursing agency fees rate hike approved. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in regular session last Thursday night, the Board of Managers of the Ward Memorial Hospital approved a rate increase for visiting nurses from Advantage Healthcare Staffing. Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez said, quote, "When we are short of nurses, we have no choice but to use the agency. That is why we have increased rates and incentives for our own nurses to try to minimize the use of agency nurses. They actually wanted more, but we got them to come down a little," end quote. The hourly rate for LVNs increased from $43.04 to $65, and the rate for RNs increased from $59.37 to $75. The rate for crisis situations will be $110 per hour. Crisis situations were defined as needs far beyond normal, such as was the case during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. Managers present for the meeting were Dr. John Fawcett, Gerald Carlson, Angel Fuentes, Frank Heslin, and Lisa Stewart. Managers Larry Hunt, Jeff Burdick, and Tommy Escamilla were not present. Barnes brings murals to Monahans. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. Usually, it is a job in the oil field that brings people to Monahans, but for Taylor Barnes, art provided the pull. As a result, some buildings in Monahans are experiencing an unusual revitalization with eye-catching murals painted on the walls, and the artist responsible for much of this transformation is 28-year-old young woman named Taylor Barnes. Taylor was born in Houston, where she was raised by a fiercely loving family. She said, quote, "They are all such big personalities, like the kooky family from a comedy film," she said. Taylor graduated from Calvin Nelms High School in 2012. She lived with her parents and two older siblings, a brother and a sister, who is very close to her. Taylor's father worked as an art framer, building frames for canvases and other art. Growing up, she said she was the kid with a sketchbook and found great therapy in drawing. Quote, "It was always a hobby, something that I didn't take seriously until I moved to Austin in 2018, Barnes said. She often did pencil and charcoal drawings of my friends and family. After graduating from high school, Taylor attended 2 years of community college and then enrolled at the University of Houston Clear Lake to study art in life drawing classes and graphic design. Quote, "My parents moved to Austin in 2018 while I was still going to the University of Houston," Barnes said. "I would go visit my parents in Austin and developed a strong liking for Austin itself and the murals I saw on many buildings in the city," she said. So, Taylor left college and moved to Austin. Taylor was inspired by the local artists who were painting large murals around town and at places such as the Hope Outdoor Gallery, which was a condo project that fell through and was partially demolished. The remaining walls became an outdoor canvas for anyone to come paint. Live art performances caught Taylor's interest after she settled in Austin. Live painting is a form of visual performance art in which artists complete a visual art piece in a public performance, often at a bar, music concert, wedding reception, or public event accompanied by a DJ or live music. Quote, "The artwork which is created live may be planned or improvisational," she said. Taylor threw herself into the art community and started to paint at events around Austin. Quote, "Artists would bring their own panels, paint and easels, and paint in front of loads of people," she said. "I fell in love with the engagement between the art and community. I went from being an isolated artist to fully engaged in the art community in 1 year," she added. In March of 2020, Taylor was offered her first paid mural job for Wanderlust Wines in Austin and hasn't looked back since. Taylor said she finds an immense freedom in getting out into the world and discovering new places. She loves to absorb it all, the local culture, scenery, and just the feeling of being there. These experiences are reflected in her work, which is mostly portraiture. As most artists, Taylor says she is fascinated by people and places. Quote, "The stories an old building can tell are fascinating. The emotions that can be evoked by a single expression can tell a story that can be completely expressed in a mural painting," she said. Friends and the group gatherings put her together with the man who would become her partner in art and life. Shea McAnally is from Monahans, and his parents, Billy and Desi McAnally, are local residents. Taylor and Shea were in Austin until COVID shut down the public gatherings. Shea left Austin and moved to Portland, Oregon, where he had his own studio, ADX. Taylor remained in Austin for 5 to 6 months before moving to Portland to be with Shea. She worked at the studio and sold wood palette paintings, which are paintings done on wood and the color mixing palette included on the bottom of the painting itself. The couple also sold their artwork online. Taylor and Shea left Portland when he started working for a wind energy company. They traveled to New Mexico and Kingsland following the wind turbine installation job. But knowing Shea's love was art, Taylor encouraged him to resume his art career. Since Shea had family in Monahans, they decided Monahans would make a good home base. It didn't take long for the jobs to start flowing in for the couple. Taylor does commission work, and Shea still sells art online. When not involved in an art project, the couple devotes their time to their hobby of gardening. Watching things grow is in itself a magnificent form of art, she said. Sales tax distribution up for a third month. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. For the third consecutive month, sales receipts distribution for Monahans are up over the same periods of 2021. Monahan's received $339,000 for the March distribution, compared to $246,000 in March of 2021, an increase of 37%. Year-to-date, the city has received $1,011,000, compared to $886,000 for the first 3 months of last year, an increase of 14%. Although the March receipts are lower than last month, Monahan City Manager is still pleased with the report. Quote, "With the March 2022 sales tax allocation, the city of Monahan's is $124,000 or 14% above the same time last year. This year's March allocation from January collections is $339,000, while up from last year 37% or $92,000, is down from last month's allocation, December 2021 collections, by $29,000 or minus 10%. "We are glad to see the positive turn from last year and hope it continues," Rexthee said. All other communities in the county also received more money than last March and for the year to date. Grand Falls received $9,974 compared to $3,800 last year, an increase of 160%. For the year, Grand Falls receipts are almost triple, with total receipts of $31,000, 164% over the $11,000 in 2021. Pyote receipts, both for the month and the year, are almost the same as 2021. For March, Pyote received $13,000 compared to $13,000 last year, up by 0.5%, and is up by 1.1% for the year, with a total of $36,379 compared to $35,969. Thorntonville received $4,481, up by 18% over last March receipts of $3,700. For the year, Thorntonville is up by 43% from $13,500 to $19,700. Wicket is also showing strong gains for both the month and the year. Wicket received $23,700, up by 31% over last March's total of $18,000. For the year, the community is up by 40% with $78,600 compared to $56,036 last year. In Reeves County, Pecos received $640,000, up by 28% for March, compared to $498,000. For the year, Pecos is up by 17% to $1.7 million, compared to $1.5 million. Balmoray increased by 8% to $6,300, compared to $5,800 in March of 2021. For the year, Balmoray received $21,000, up by 7%. Toya had no receipts for March, leaving the community down by 44% for the year, with a total of $4,400 compared to $7,800. In Pecos County, Fort Stockton dropped off by 33% to $226,000 for March, compared to $341,000. For the year, the town is down by 15% with $920,000 compared to $1,087,000. Ira Ann is up by 4% for the month with $32,000 compared to $30,000, but is still down for the year by 18% with a total of $87,900 compared to $107,000 last year at this time. In Winkler County, Kermit is rebounding strongly with a March increase of 46% to $134,000 compared to $91,000 last year. Year-to-date, Kermit is up by 50% with a total of $459,000. Wink drops slightly for the month with $23,300 compared to $24,300, a drop of 4.1%. But for the year, the community is up by 19% with a total of $86,000 compared to $72,000. Winkler County also had strong gains with 64% for the month with $273,000 compared to $166,000. For the year, the county had received $743,000 compared to $472,000 last year, a gain of 47%. Andrews gained 23% for the month to $562,000 compared to $453,000. For the year, Andrews is up by 16% with a total of $1,800,000 compared to $1,600,000 last year, a gain of 16%. Crane remains down for the year by 18% with receipts of $219,000 compared to $270,000. But for the month, Crane gained 17% with March receipts of $82,000 compared to $72,000. The city of Midland is up by almost $1 million with $4.9 million, up by 25%. For the year, Midland is up by 28% with a total of $17.6 million. Midland County is up by over 60%, both for the month and the year. For March, the county received $4.5 million, a gain of 63.4%, and for the year, receipt totals are $14.3 million, up by 62%. Odessa received $4.1 million for March, up by 19%, and $14.5 million for the year, up by 12%. Monahans, Andrews, Fort Stockton, and Ira Ann all assess a sales tax rate of 2%. Pecos, Crane, Balmoré, and Toya assess 1.5%. The City of Midland assesses 1.25%, and tax rate for Kermit and Wink is 1.0%. County rates for Midland and Winkler counties are 0.5%. Statewide, Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager sent cities, counties, transit systems, and special purpose taxing districts $913.3 million in local sales tax allocations for March, 19.8% more than in March 2021. These allocations are based on sales made in January by businesses that report tax monthly.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.